Welcome. You are listening to the UC Davis Center for Poverty Research Seminar Series. I'm the Center's Director, Ann Stevens. This series brings scholars and policy experts from around the country to discuss their work on poverty and poverty research. In October 2012, we hosted Heather Rose, a Center faculty affiliate and Associate Professor of Education at UC Davis. She is also an Adjunct Policy Fellow at the Public Policy Institute of California. Her research focuses on K-12 education, school finance, and academic standards and accountability. Here is Rose presenting her seminar, Does California's School Finance System Leave Poor Children Behind?
Well, I'm particularly happy to be here today. How many of you were at the event last night that was co-hosted by the Poverty Center and the School of Education? There's a lot of talk about school finance issues there, so I feel like now I have the opportunity to set the record straight on a few things. So I needed my platform today so I don't walk around my house ranting like a crazy person. So this is good. So I want to talk about school finance issues through the lens of this question, which is, how does our finance system help or not help poor children? Is it leaving our poor students behind? And so if you want the quick answer, so you can just go on with your Friday afternoon, here's one answer for you. No. For those of you who don't like that answer, I've got the other answer, which is yes. So all of this is just to say that by the end of the hour and 20 minutes, I'm not really going to give you a specific answer to this question. I think it's pretty murky. But I want to sort of sort through some of the details that I think are important to think about when thinking about this issue in the first place. So before I get started with the nitty-gritty, I want to just sort of lay out what the big education reforms have been over the last few decades in California. In the 70s and 80s, the state was really focused on equalizing spending per pupil across school districts. So that was there was a big push for that, and I'll sort of show you how far we've come. In the 90s, the state was really focused on sort of providing a floor for spending on education, providing more resources for schools. And you sort of saw that happening with Proposition 98. Then in 2000, we really started focusing on setting academic standards for the students in the state and having a sort of standards-based accountability system, which has really led to the questions at hand today, which are, have we been providing schools with enough resources to meet those very specified standards now? So it's sort of this question of enough. And then can we design a more rational system for allocating the money we have? So I'm going to sort of focus on the second part of that question, which is the rationality of our finance system today. And so I'm going to take a page out of Hillary's book here. I think when you gave your talk, you had this picture that had been driving your research questions over the last few years. So this is my picture that has really been sort of guiding my research over the last decade, I would say. So every dot on this graph is an elementary school. It's in 2007. And it's plotted based on the percentage of students in this school who scored proficient or higher on the English language arts part of the California standards test. So that's on the vertical axis. And then across the horizontal axis, we have the percentage of economically disadvantaged students in the school. So today, when I talk about economically disadvantaged, the specific thing I mean is the percentage of students in the school who are on the free or reduced price lunch program. And what that means in more practical terms is that they are they come from families that are below 180% of the poverty line. So just to give you an example, in 2007 for a family of four, the poverty line was about $20,000. So we're talking about kids who are less than about $38,000, coming from families that are earning less than about $38,000 in California. So just sort of put that in perspective. So what this shows is that in district or in schools where there are many more poor kids, many fewer of them are scoring proficient on these tests. So this is sort of all feeding into this achievement gap that we have, where poor students are not performing as well as the more affluent students in the state. And so this is sort of the guiding picture I have in mind. So in this sense, to the extent that our finance system is related to this, we are leaving quite a few kids behind. If you want to look at a different measure of test scores, this sort of shows the same thing with the API score in the state. This is a score that's assigned to every school based on a whole host of tests. It ranges from 200 to 1,000. The goal for every school is an 800. And I think, if I kind of got crafty here. One of the things I wanted to show you is that if you look, again, this is the same measure of poverty, you know, the worst scoring schools up here are still far better than the best scoring schools where there are high numbers of kids in poverty. So this is sort of one of the fundamental driving issues, I think. So when we think about a school finance system, I definitely want to keep this in mind. And I also want to keep a few principles in mind that would sort of, I don't know, be principles for a more coherent school finance system. And those are, and I should actually say, too, please feel free to interrupt with questions throughout. This is, it'll be more fun for me, for sure, and for you, too, probably. So those are the ground rules. But when we think about principles of a school finance system in theory, one would be that we're actually meeting the needs of the students. So we're sort of giving them enough. The other is that we want to adjust for differences in cost. So perhaps disadvantaged kids have extra needs and we should be supplying them with more resources to address those. Or labor costs might be higher in some districts than others, and we might want to address those with a school finance system as well. But we want to make these cost adjustments based on factors that a district can't control. So if you go back to this picture, we don't necessarily want to give schools more money because their test scores are low, because then they might not have an incentive to raise their test scores if they're going to lose the money. So we might want to give them more money because they have a lot of kids in poverty, and, you know, not base those resource decisions on things that are controllable by the schools themselves. Okay, the other thing we want to do is allocate funds transparently. So we want to adjust for some big costs, but not every single solitary difference between schools, because we'll sort of be back to the crazy system that we're currently in, which we'll talk more about in a second. Once we sort of figure out what cost factors we want to adjust for, any district with the same set of characteristics should be getting the same amount of revenue afterwards. And then finally, and I'm not going to talk too much about this today, but there should be this balance between state and local authority, and that's something else the state has been struggling with. Yeah?
That's a question on the measure of disadvantage.
Yeah.
How accurate is it?
Accurate-ish. So now that my daughter finally entered school, it comes from one pink piece of paper where I check a box. So, partially. So that's partially how accurate it is. Some districts are better than other at getting that information about free and reduced price lunch. But if you actually look at different measures, if you look at the Title I measure, which is a different count of poor kids in the school, which is less subject to the sort of human reporting errors, I think, you get a pretty high correlation with free and reduced price lunch. So I think we're in the ballpark at least. But there are other sort of crazy things that happen with some school districts. If they exceed a certain threshold of that for 1 year, they just continue to report 100% every year thereafter. And actually, this is an important point to bring up, that Maggie Weston is also here. And Maggie has worked with me on all of this. She and John Sonstily and I have been doing this whole, this sort of comes from a series of projects. So she is going to answer all the tough questions in the room and will correct me when I say anything that's off base. That's about right. Okay.
Is there any for free and reduced price lunch? Is there ever any income verification audit or anything?
I don't know, actually, to be perfectly honest.
You have to audit 10% of, randomly audit 10% of student applications.
Okay. Good.
I think the view is it's pretty sketchy. But, yeah, probably crudely right.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I mean, sketchy in terms of the actual...
And, you know,
verification that goes on. But.
Yeah, and, you know, it covers a pretty big group of people. I got school attendance zone data at one point for a prior project, and if you look at that, you can actually get, census income for the families in those school attendance zones. And, okay, for my sample of 50 schools, so we're talking a limited sample, I think if you go back to a picture like this, it kind of tightens that up a bit. I mean, these are pretty broad categories of poverty there.
Yeah.
It's an okay-ish measure. It's kind of what we've got, and it's a starting point, but I think we probably can do better. Okay, so specifically what I want to focus on today is talking a lot about the current finance system that we have, kind of where the money comes from, how it's distributed, and how that's related to poverty. So kind of a school finance 101 talk. And then I want to relate this to the governor's new proposal for funding schools, which is this idea of a weighted student formula, which is really the hot topic in school finance today in Sacramento and across the state. So that'll be fun to talk about. And then finally, we'll maybe get to this question of are resources adequate, and we'll get there. Okay. Before, though, I do want to turn the tables for a second and take the attention off me and put it on you and have you do this quick little quiz, which is, you can talk to your neighbors, but answer the following questions. What share of the federal budget is spent on education? What share of the state budget is spent on education? And then finally, think about it now from the school's perspective. What share of their budgets come from federal, state, and then local discretionary sources? And by that I mean the sources that the school district could actually tap into if it wanted, you know, if it wanted to raise more money.
K-12. This
is K-12. Thank you. Take a minute. Talk amongst yourselves. No, yeah, and don't, you can't talk to her. What was that?
State budget, the general fund, or the overall?
All right, state budget clarification would be the general fund. General fund. The general fund.
That's a green nationwide or California?
For California.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
For California.
I know the answer.
Do you? Yeah, a question. Or an answer.
But it's mostly 10%.
What was that?
All right, we're good.
85.
Oh, I just mean, those are the only three things. So either the state or the federal or the local. But you'll see in a minute there's some murkiness between that was all I, yeah. All right. I know. I should have gone to that clicker presentation. All right. I'm in a school of ed now. I should know how to manage a room better. But let's get back to attention here. Okay, so Scott said he knew the answer for the first part there, the federal budget.
No, I didn't.
Oh, I thought you did.
The third question for the federal.
Sorry.
National averages, but I didn't know it's California.
So who wants to venture an answer for the federal?
Less than one.
How many?
Depends on how you treat loan guarantees.
Okay.
No,
don't.
K through 12.
K through 12.
Oh.
Yeah.
Less than 1%.
Okay. So we have like some really low percentages here. What about the state budget, and by state budget specifically the general fund? Higher than 30s.
K through 12.
Got some 30s out. Okay, we'll go with that. Let's see how we're doing so far. Oh, maybe.
What's the answer on the state?
So we'll start here with the federal. So I'm not even going to give you the right answer there. So education in total is about 3%. Yeah, it's okay. So super small is my only point in that. And I know it's bad to present this kind of stuff with people who really do public finance. So really small is the answer. State spending, though, in the general fund, K to 14. So some of this is going to community colleges. It's a pretty small slice,
right.
But it's about it's you know, they get I guess it isn't there, is it? That is K to 12. Yeah, so it's about 40% of the general fund. And this is sort of a rule set by Proposition 98. So this was part of that 1980s reform where we wanted 40% of our budget to be general fund to go to education, K to 12 education. Okay, now if you think about it from the school's perspective, what share of its money is sort of dictated by the federal government, the state government, and then locally? Sorry. Sure.
When you say general fund, is that the entire money that the state gets?
No.
Well,
I thought the question wasn't the entire money that the state gets.
Yeah, so, okay, so you guys are calling me on a lot of technicalities here. So, not entirely. And so this is just the general fund, but it is a huge, you know, it's a big part of the general fund. So my point in all of this is really just to say it's not a huge federal spending priority. It is a pretty big state spending priority. But then when you think about it from the perspective of the districts themselves, what portion are they getting? I mean, because, you know, a small piece of a huge pie can still be a lot of money for a school district. So from the school district's perspective, where is it getting its money? So what percentage from the state would you guys say then? We'll just start with that one. 80-ish percent. You guys are good. Yeah, so I'll cut to the chase here. This is basically, I'm just going to want to talk about each four slices of this pie in a lot more detail. But state money, sort of state-controlled money, it basically makes up this huge revenue limit piece, that sort of general money that the school can spend on regular everyday expenses, sort of how it sees fit. These state categorical programs are sort of have a lot of strings tied to them, but this, all of this, about 85%, is coming from state-controlled sources. The federal government supplies about 9%, and then other local discretionary sources are about 6%. So I'll go into each of these slices and sort of talk about how, you know, where the money comes from and then how it's spent based on the poverty level of schools. So far, so good? All right, so I want to talk about this biggest chunk of money first, these revenue limits. And revenue limit is kind of a funny terminology. The way these funds work is the state has basically set a revenue goal for each school district, call it $5,200. And this is sort of an entitlement that every school district should get. The first way money flows into that is through, a big chunk is through property taxes based on the value of the property in the school district zones. Because of Prop 13, these property taxes are capped at 1% of the value of homes in the state. So that 1% is going to vary from school district to school district because the property values themselves vary across the different school districts. And the other reason that that amount might vary is because the portion of that 1% that goes to school districts varies from school district to school district. The portion is set based on whatever proportion school districts were getting of their property taxes back in the late 70s when Proposition 13 was passed. So there's a lot of reasons why this chunk of money is going to vary from school district to school district. But that's the first part that gets a school district up to that revenue limit, that revenue goal. After that, the state is just going to fill in the rest. So it doesn't matter necessarily from a school district's perspective if they get a lot of money from property taxes or they don't, because the state is just going to fill in that difference. And so what this actually looks like for a couple of specific districts here, take Oakland. This is how much Oakland gets toward that goal in terms of its share of local property taxes. So the state is actually putting in a lot of state aid for Oakland's revenue limit. San Francisco, they actually make it up to that $5,200 mark pretty close with just their property taxes alone. So the state is actually giving them just a pretty small amount of additional aid. But then there's a place like Newport Mesa, who's, when you take their share of property taxes, it actually exceeds this amount and goes all the way up over $8,000. So they basically get their revenue limit amount of $5,200, and they get to keep all that extra. So that's called an excess tax district. They have taxes in excess of that state goal, and they get to keep it. Now, don't get too worried about this. last night, it became a big topic of conversation. It felt like there were claims that if we just did away with this one issue of our school finance system, we could fix everything. But we really can't. If you basically took all the excess taxes across the state, divided them up among all the kids, you basically have a little sliver like about that. It's about $70 a kid statewide. So this is sort of the statewide average picture where, you know, about a third of the money is coming from property taxes, about two-thirds from state aid, and that tiny little sliver is excess taxes. But because these excess tax districts, they're also sometimes called basic aid districts, just in case you've heard that terminology thrown around. The reason that they are called basic aid districts was because although you know, they're meeting their revenue limit with their taxes alone, they were still entitled to a tiny little bit of state aid. They got the only the basic part of the state aid, which was like a couple, maybe it was like $120 of other state aid, but nothing else, no other state aid above and beyond that. So just to point out a few of these places, because I think people are kind of interested in them sometimes, here's a list of the top 24 unified districts with excess taxes. So Owens Valley Unified basically has excess taxes in the amount of $2,500 per pupil, but there's only 37 kids there. So not very, I mean, we could probably not worry about them. And so you can kind of see St. Helena's kind of in there in Napa County. They have $9,000 of excess taxes. These are the top 24. Actually, once you get down below this one, the amount of, there's like nine others that have nine others that have excess taxes, you know, somewhere between $100 and $900. And one thing that actually happens, some of the reasons why a district might be called an excess tax district now, because remember we have that $5,200 revenue limit amount, the goal, and if a district had gotten all of that revenue limit with excess taxes, it wouldn't be getting any state aid. Well, what happened with some of the budget cuts recently is that the state decreased those revenue limits, and so by just simply dropping the amount that the state was targeting for every school district, some school districts were sort of thrown into this category without necessarily having become better off in any other sense. So just
to ground California relative to the rest of the U.S., if you go back a slide, what's the national average for the share of costs that are property versus state? I mean, I know it's much higher, but just how much of an outlier are we?
Yeah, so actually this is something that Maggie and I are working on, thanks to actually one of the Poverty Center GSR grants, where we're really trying to look at this nationwide. And it's kind of tricky because in California we have this issue where, although we have this 1% property tax that is considered a local tax with the federal data, it essentially is this statewide tax. It's not a local discretionary tax in the sense that a school district could raise their mm-hmm. property tax rate and get more revenue in that sense. So we're trying to get a better handle on which, you know, how to classify money and sort of under the state purview or under local purview. So I don't know. Can you?
I said 44% local, 44% state. The rest, 8, whatever,
is 12. Yeah, so kind of more like half and half.
Only 12 states have a majority coming from states with them.
Thank you. Yeah.
So how does, like, Serrano 3, who that limited their range in poor people spending across districts, how does this tax fit into that?
So the Serrano versus Priest lawsuit was basically what led to this equalization push in California in the first place. And the way that kind of worked was the state said, we want to have this revenue limit of, I'll just say, $5,200 per kid. And at that point, there were some districts that were really close to that and some districts that were really far away from it. What that meant was that if you were far away from that limit, you were allowed to set a tax rate that you could grow to that limit a lot faster than if you were really close to it. So it's kind of it was a limit in the sense that districts, not many districts were there yet, and it wanted districts to get there within a certain amount of time and to close that, you make sure that all districts were spending within $100 per pupil of each other. But there were some technicalities there, and now Maggie can correct me. She'll see if I was really listening to her when she was giving me the details on this. But the rule was that I think 90% of school districts had to be within that, or 90% of students had to be within that $100 band. And if you adjust that $100 band for inflation, which it was, we're kind of right now at a $400 band. And so, actually, if you look at revenue limits, we've broken this up by, these are elementary districts, these are high school districts, and these are unified districts. So let's just take this slice right here first. There are large, medium, and small, and these are just box and whisker plots, so sort of showing you where half of, or this is the 75th percentile, this is the 25th percentile of students, actually, in these districts. But basically, large, unified districts, there's almost no variation in revenue limit funds for them. So that's where most of the students are. Medium unified, you get a little bit of spread. Small unified, you're still kind of, you know, most of the kids are within that few hundred dollars of each other, and then you have some outliers. So by and large, this source of funding has been pretty equalized across districts. The one big difference, though, is that those revenue limits are different for unified districts than they are for high school districts and elementary districts. So high school districts have a higher revenue limit. It's just over 6,000. Unified districts have a revenue limit or goal of about 5,200, and elementary districts are closer to 5,000. So you'll get differences in school spending based on the type of school district that you are. And those are sort of born into the distribution formula because the Serrano decision, you know, sort of set these revenue limits in that way. That answer your question? Okay, so this is just sort of overall how these funds are distributed, but what I really wanted to focus on is, well, how is this related to poverty? But I guess I didn't want to do that yet, because I want to focus when I go through this on unified districts, just to sort of keep the graphs a little bit simpler. So just to put this in perspective, the state has unified districts, which serve K to 12, elementary districts, which are usually K up until you get to high school, and then high school districts after that. About 67% of students are in unified districts. That's where most kids are. About 20% in elementary and about 10% in high school districts. So I'm going to focus the pictures on this, but the other ones look pretty similar. So if we look at this question of revenue limit funds, so these are revenue limit funds up here on a per pupil basis. This again is that measure of poverty, the percent of kids on free or reduced price lunch. Here every circle is a school district, and the size of the circle is based on the enrollment in that school district. So this big school district right here is Los Angeles. It's got about 10% of the students in the whole state, so it's pretty big. And this is really just to show you that revenue limit funds have been pretty equalized. It's a pretty straight line across here by district type. So these are just the unified districts. There's not much variation. If anything, these districts at the high end of the poverty distribution get a tiny bit more. If you run a regression, you get an intercept of about 5,300 with a slope of about 25. But this is if you don't include the excess taxes. If you actually include the excess taxes in that definition of revenue limits, what happens is you get a few more affluent districts with some of those excess taxes. So you actually get a negative. If you were to, I mean, it doesn't really show up here visually that well, but if you run a regression, you actually get sort of a negative relationship now between funding and poverty. You get an intercept of about 5,600 with a negative slope of about 354, meaning that basically every poor kid is getting about $354 less on average than a kid who would not be classified as poor with this definition. So revenue limits, the big chunk of money, pretty equalized, but those excess taxes mean that more affluent kids are getting a little bit more. Oh, thank you. We'll come back. Yeah. So that's sort of the general funding for schools, sort of the ongoing regular education expenses. But then we have that other set of categorical programs that make up it's about like $2,000 worth of the overall funding. And there are at least 60 different categorical programs in the state. This is the biggest one here is special education. Economic impact aid is about 8% of the slice. That is basically doled out based on whether a kid is poor or not. That definition Maggie, I'm going to let you give that definition because you'll remember it better than I. So it's if you're English learner and
Title I,
either of those, and you can get double counted, but it's about $300 per eligible kid. Class size reduction is another categorical program. This was to give schools additional money to reduce their class sizes in grades kindergarten through third. There's like adult education programs. So lots of little tiny programs. had one little, so about 75% of the funds in this program, though, come from the 10 biggest programs. So there's a lot of big programs giving a lot of money, but lots of little tiny programs with lots of little strings attached that, when you talk to school districts, kind of drive them crazy. So if we look, though, at how this money is, if you take all of this, and actually, I'm not going to quite take all of it, I'm going to take special education out. It's kind of hard sometimes to think about special education and what part of the money comes from the state and what part of the money comes from the feds. So for the rest of this talk, we're just going to ignore the special education funds for a minute. But just know that there was some reform in how we allocated special education revenue not that long ago, and it's pretty much doled out on an equal per pupil basis across these things called SELPAs, which are these special education local plan areas. So sort of groups of districts that are part of these SELPAs. The SELPAs get a money sort of on a per kid rate, and then that group sort of decides how it's going to spend those funds. So these categorical funds, if you look at how they're related to poverty, there's a pretty steep positive slope here where more disadvantaged kids are getting more money. And on average, that means about an extra $1,800 per poor child. So a really strong relationship with poverty here. So revenue limit funds, revenue limit funds, you don't really get this picture, but these are a pretty strong positive relationship. The next slice of the pie I want to talk about are federal programs. And here, Title I is the biggest of the federal programs, and is also a program designed to help poor children. So we should probably expect to see a pretty steep upward slope there as well. You don't see much of a slope here, but it definitely is. You're getting more federal funds as your poverty level increases, and certainly out here you can see that districts with more disadvantaged students end up with a lot more federal revenue. Questions? Good. Okay.
Are you doing weighted or unweighted?
These are weighted, actually. Yeah. So the slopes that I'm showing you are weighted.
A lot of it's high because of Los Angeles.
Right.
In this one, yeah. But if you go back to
it's fine.
LA definitely pulls things up. And
I think you're doing it right.
Yeah. And then that's certainly also important keep that in mind when we come back to talk about what the state's been talking about in terms of school finance reform later, because certainly what's happening in LA is kind of a driving force about what's possible to do statewide. Okay, and then the last little sliver I want to talk about here are the local revenue sources. And so these are, if a district's leasing or renting out its land, stuff that it has access to, that makes up about 20%. It can also raise parcel taxes. So these are not based on the value of your land, but based on whether you have a unit of land or not. So that makes up about 10% of those local fees. So we're talking overall, this part of the pie is about $600 per pupil, so that's about $60 per pupil statewide. So pretty small in terms of revenue-raising capabilities on a statewide basis.
And what's the 46?
Where
do the excess property tax things end up? Are they in here?
They're in the revenue limit chunk. They're in that big,
in the first thing
that we saw, yeah. Yeah.
Gosh, so, that's so interesting. I think probably most people's priors is that the parcel tax is the majority of this.
Yeah, it's a pretty tiny piece. So if you actually look, so here's I just pulled out a few to give you a taste of who's getting these. LA has no parcel taxes. Berkeley has they end up raising about $3,000 per student in parcel taxes.
Right, exactly.
Davis is about $800. This is just to give you sort of a sense here. There aren't that many districts that actually have parcel taxes. I think I counted this morning. There are 100 districts, I guess, with parcel taxes that end up providing more than $100 per student. So I guess that's about 10% of districts have something, but not necessarily a lot. And it could be that some of those districts, for whatever reason, are sort of lower on the revenue limit side of things in the first place. So you wouldn't want to read too much into just this one piece of the of the pie. And if you look then at what's happening with local revenue, taking all those sources together, and we look at the same picture, you kind of get this negative slope where more affluent districts, through those various forms, are able to raise more money locally than districts with higher levels of poverty. So we have these sort of countervailing sources of, you know, federal and state categorical programs really are targeted toward poor students and are going to districts in the way that you would expect, but these are sort of other local and funds aren't.
I'm Ann Stevens, the director of the Center for Poverty Research at UC Davis, and I want to thank you for listening. The center is one of three federally designated poverty research centers in the United States. Our mission is to facilitate nonpartisan academic research on domestic poverty, to disseminate this research, and to train the next generation of poverty scholars. Core funding comes from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. For more information about the center, visit us online at poverty.ucdavis.edu.